This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theofanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. This is Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theofanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. How's everything going, Tom? Haven't talked to you in a little while?
I'm good. Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Well, we've been doing pre-records the last two shows. Yeah, it's been good. You know, what do we have? There's news. We have news.
Yes, we do. Today, we received an email from a friend. Carol, are you familiar with Carol Rainey?
Carol Rainey, yep. Ex-wife of Hopkins.
She's Hopkins, yes. Apparently, she decided to kind of spill the beans on Hopkins and Jacobs. Duet there, and she has basically put out all the information of what she felt and saw, and what the goings on there was between those two individuals over the many years they've been working together. Although they seem like individuals, they
by two individuals you mean Hopkins and Jacobs,
and David Jacobs, yes. And there were the movers and the shakers and the abduction phenomenon, you know, for the last 20 years or so. And so this puts a pretty big dumper on these two fellas. And these are things that, you know, I think was said to you.
What did she say?
Well, basically is that, they were making the stories fit, whatever they were going to write about. And this is what, a lot of people had argued back in those days with books like the one with Linda Cortile and, that humongous story that, was going to become a movie and so on.
Right.
It ended up turning out to be, pretty much a hoax for the most part.
And so it would have been a make the facts.
That's the unfortunate thing that. Unfortunately, these are the things that we always talked about back then, and even now that we see a lot of folks in this field, put out stories just to fit whatever they're trying to sell. But reality is something different.
Yeah. I'll tell you what.
Really pay attention to this.
I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put I'll put the whole article up in the news section of our website on www.spectrumradionetwork.com. If you go to the news section later on tonight after we get off the show and we jabber for a bit, I'll throw that up there, and we'll get a copy of that up there, and you can check it out. The other big news is the bird's dying, the cow's dropping dead. That's pretty weird. We don't know what that is yet.
Fish.
Fish, yeah.
Fish dying by the thousands.
Right.
In numerous places for
which
that
is
matter.
Bad news for us seafood eaters. And, makes me sad.
Yes.
Okay. I'll tell you what. We got
that we all keep an eye on all this stuff.
Yeah, sure. Well, tonight we got Vincent Bridges. And he'll be giving a talk tonight. Yep. So could you just do an introduction? I know you have some information on him. Would you mind?
Tom? Certainly could. Vincent is an internationally known author, a lecturer, an esoteric historian, the co-author of two books on the mysterious 20th century alchemist Fulcanelli, and an expert commentator and historical consultant on 9 History Channel and Discovery Channel shows on Nostradamus. He's also the author of The Ophanic Revelation, and is currently working on several books on Shakespeare, Rudolf Fine Prague, and the Hermetic Revolution. Welcome, Vincent.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Benson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
Can you hear me?
I thought we lost you there for a second.
Yep. No, I can hear you. You're good. Your mic's fine.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Could we start out perhaps with Shakespeare?
Sure. Everybody knows Shakespeare, right? But yep. Nobody really knows basically how Shakespeare became Shakespeare. In other words, he's the case of this sort of innocent, fairly well-educated guy who disappears for 8 years and becomes the greatest playwright in English literature.
Yeah.
And nobody really knows what happened to him in those 8 years. And that's where all the Shakespeare was this guy or that guy really comes in, because there's this gap. So if you start thinking about where Shakespeare could actually have learned some of the things that are obviously in the plays, and you start looking for sources, you turn up, a main suspect. Okay. And that's this fellow by the name of Dr. John Dee, who was sort of the Einstein of the 16th century. His personal library was larger than any other two or three continental university libraries in existence. And Dr. Dee had a close relationship with Queen Elizabeth, and he was also talking to higher intelligences. He called them angels, but the fact of the matter is that he wanted to bump up his knowledge a level and decided to go right to the source, you know.
Right.
They viewed things a little bit differently in the 16th century. And that still gives him a certain cachet of perhaps craziness. He's not quite taken as seriously because of all that. But undeniably, he's one of these key figures in this junction point between the ancient world and the medieval world and the more modern world that grew out of it. And in that junction point, along with Shakespeare and Dee and Rudolph II, is this group called the Rosicrucians.
Mm.
Now, the Rosicrucians, literally, historically, were a factor in something called the 30 Years' War. Okay? Their main, the Rosicrucians influenced government and society most in this time period right before the beginning of the 30 Years' War in Prague and in the Empire, when there was an emperor elected who was actually a proto-Rosicrucian, a pseudo-Rosicrucian. And he, of course, was married to the daughter of the King of England, at whose wedding Shakespeare produced both The Tempest and his semi-autobiographical play, The Winter's Tale. So all these things kind of wrap around each other in this interesting little puzzle. And as I discovered, there's a sort of oral history connection in Prague that suggests Shakespeare was friendly with some of these early Rosicrucians, and that he had actually been in Prague in the 1590s. So working back from those kind of rumors, which again, there's no real documentation, it's like, well, how could that have happened? Where could that work? And lo and behold, right in Dee's diary, there's a group of individuals known as the Brothers Garland, or the Garland Brothers, one of which, Edward Garland, turns out to be Edward Dyer, a fairly well-known minor Elizabethan sonneteer, friend of Sir Philip Sidney, a player, shall we say, a spy.
Mm.
And the other Garlands are more anonymous. One of them is Francis Garland. And Francis Garland is sort of like Shakespeare's nom de guerre, his spy name. He's the name that Dee always referred to him by. And it may have had something to do with the fact that Dee knew that he was working for Sir Francis Walsingham, and therefore Francis Garland. But whenever there is a mention of Garland, there's no record of Shakespeare being anywhere. In other words, they're sort of like Clark Kent and Superman. They don't exactly occupy the same space.
Right.
And in the 1590s, Shakespeare would register a poem in London just a few days after Francis Garland had visited Dee at Mortlake. And this happened twice. So it's sort of like Francis Garland was showing his work to his old mentor, Dee, or Shakespeare, that is, was showing his work. So mm-hmm. once making that connection, then it was just simply a matter of, okay, all these things happened not in England, but in Prague. And once you sort of stand that whole story that, that we think we know about Shakespeare and even what we think we know about John Dee, when you go, okay, what if he really spent most of that time in what was at that point the most sophisticated, the most hermetic, esoteric, magical capital in Europe, the very center of all this hermetic revolution, ferment of knowledge and alchemy and magic. And you know, what if that's where Shakespeare got certain of his understandings?
Mm. The Seven Hills area, right?
Well, yeah, there's Seven Hills in Prague and five major synagogues, sort of like it's its own little seal of truth. And truly, going back over 1,000 years, the city of Prague grew up around a really incredible alignment. And that alignment is, if you stand up on the hill at Prague Castle, at the spot where the old rotunda from the 10th century used to be, and you look out across Prague, you'll see another rotunda called the Rotunda of the Holy Cross. And then beyond that is the Rotunda of St. Longinus, the figure who thrust the spear in Jesus' side. Mm. And that direction leads towards the winter solstice sunrise. And the line itself is within, a few meters of being exactly on the center of the church at Golgotha in Jerusalem. So from Prague, you can look out across this alignment of 1,000-year-old rotundas and see the sun rising, aligning with the center of the galaxy, as if it's standing on Jerusalem.
Amazing how many places on the planet you see that.
Well, very few do you actually see the combination of the winter solstice and right directly to Jerusalem.
Right.
So all of this sort of interweaving of different ideas is why Prague, both back in the 16th century and apparently even now, is part of this hermetic revolution, this sort of ferment of a more Gnostic view of things, if you will.
It's also hit by a meteorite, wasn't it?
Well, that's the interesting prehistory. The story from Wolfram's Parzival, and Wolfram actually spent some time in the service of Ottokar II, so he probably heard this story firsthand. The story is that there was a big battle in heaven when Lucifer was cast out, and that a stone out of his crown, a big emerald, fell to the earth and created the bowl of Bohemia. And the meteorite was fairly intense. It was so intense at the center, which just happens to be that area right in those Seven Hills of Prague, that it melted the core granite and fused it with whatever the meteoritic material was. And then it splashed out in a big arc to the east. And that's where you find moldavite.
Would have pulverized, yeah.
Well, you can find it in big chunks, big green glass.
Okay.
And then part of the meteor apparently was greenish enough that it actually was blue, sort of a blue, deep blue glass. And that's sort of the key to a variety of reasons why Prague became so special, the combination of the energy coming up from the ground and this alignment that had been built to kind of deal with it,
right,
created this sort of crucible, again, for all this hermetic thought. Fairly interesting.
Very
how
interesting.
That worked itself out over time.
And Tom, do you have a question?
Tell me. Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
On the Rosicrucians, around that particular time period when Shakespeare may have been in Prague, there was just sort of coming into their own right around that time, were they not?
Yeah, there had been a very interesting group of people again, the Brotherhood of the Rose Garland, who had adopted a variety of kind of odd, almost tantric meditation practices a century or so earlier than this. And Rudolf II's father had been part of that kind of idea or movement, and Rudolf himself considered himself as one of these brothers of the garland. And apparently Dee and Kelly were also kind of in on the joke or in on the story. And so from that nexus in the 1580s and 1590s, a decade or so later would become the Rosicrucians. And some of the same people who were part of this circle in the 1590s, in the 1610s and 20s, would be at the forefront of, say, the Battle of White Mountain. And these would be the first Rosicrucians, the people who were part of that first spreading the Fama and so forth. So it really kind of starts in the 1590s and then kind of ends or goes underground in the 1560s and a little later.
So it didn't have a very long lifespan.
No. No, and again, no one really after the 1620s wanted to talk about it much.
Go ahead, Tom.
But like the Fama story, what did you think of that? Or like, what do you in your research? What have you found out about that?
Well,
like the Rosicrucian story with Rosencruz and
both the Confessions and the Fama are a really slick piece of propaganda. And they're slick because they take all of the motifs that were current right there at that, you know, 16th, 17th century shift, and they put them into a plausible story. And, you know, that plausible story may or may not have any direct reality. In other words, if you go looking for a literal Christian Rosencrantz, you probably are not going to find him. Although there are some interesting connections and suggestions. But what you do find is a group of people who found that story fascinating enough to start, again, a political movement, actually a spiritual revolution, if you want to call it that. And it's not so much who was in the group and what they really thought or believed as the way that piece of propaganda was used to create a movement that we're really sort of the product of at the moment. Science, and again, all of our New Age ideas were sort of like 400 years ahead of their time at this point, but they were part of the larger parcel of the culture that was trying to emerge. And, you know, there was a huge reaction. And eventually, of course, the Catholic Church won, and we had... Go ahead.
Yeah. But who do you think was the individuals that may have put out the initial, you know, information and the posters and the two major books and stories?
That's a really interesting and much larger story. Briefly, though, Dee, on his way from Prague back to England, stopped at a number of states in northern Germany. And all of those state little cities and little areas that he stopped would produce a small group of Rosicrucians. And one of those, probably the group in Bremen, Hamburg, that general region, are the ones that put out that first kind of wave. And the reason why we know that is they used John Dee's hieroglyphic monad as one of the marks, one of the symbols, if you will, of their little group. So those groups, those places where we have the first pamphlets and ideas where the early copies of the Fama and so forth came from are the same spots that Dee stopped at on his way back to England in 1589. And then there's another current connected to Edward Kelly that is a weird underground current that actually ends up in Denmark and Sweden after the 30 Years' War, the papers and information. Mm-hmm. So there's two different kind of threads that kind of work there to produce what would eventually become our basic Rosicrucian ideas, and then the elaborations on that. In other words, the alchemical ideas and the whole idea of the alchemy of time.
So there's the John Dee thread, and there's the Kelly thread.
Right, and most of the English-speaking world, you know, they don't really look at Kelly. They don't really understand how Kelly fits into the continental pattern of, you know, alchemy and esotericism, and again, outright politics. Because, of course, Dee's in English. He went back home to England, you know. Very hard to get the sources. Until recently, almost impossibly hard. But thanks to the Velvet Revolution, it's much easier to actually get access to some of these archives in the Czech Republic and so forth.
Right. I was wondering, maybe we could hearken back a little bit to Kelly, and he also has a very interesting story.
Yeah, Kelly is one of these historical kind of flukes that you just kind of shake your head at.
Yeah.
You know, he's the kind of guy that if they made a movie about him, you know, you'd want Johnny Depp to play him, something like that. Because a truly tortured, bizarre, over-the-top kind of person. And again, you know, he's a guy that really didn't have an identity. His identity as Edward Kelly or Edward Talbot all may have been a fake. He seems to have faked his own horoscope. And when exactly he died and from what is still sort of a mystery. And along the way, you have to kind of wonder at a guy who tends to show up at a lot of very important historical moments, and at the same time is known for poisons and alchemy and drugs and talking to angels, and ends up a knight of the empire with money and houses and fame in the imperial city. And again, loses it just as quickly. So it's sort of like when you sort of take a look at that just as a historical arc, you go, wow, what was that one about? You know, we really can't know from this side, so what's the real story there?
Okay.
So that's the fascination is,
yeah,
what
it's a
is
convoluted
the story?
Yeah. I want you to tell the story of, because I thought it was fascinating, of John Dee talking to the wanting to communicate with angels, and there was a stone involved that came out of that. Could you cover that a bit, because I found it fascinating?
Well, okay.
I know we're jumping around a bit here, but
that's fine.
We'll tie it all up.
We certainly will. John Dee had a fascination with shoe stones or scrying stones. And that's a good Renaissance magical tradition going back to Agrippa. So he had a couple of those, and in the early 1580s, he scared his servants half out of their wits by trying to get them to see something in the stones. And nothing really worked, and et cetera, until Kelly showed up. And Kelly either was trying to run a con on him, or actually was more clairvoyant than he thought he was, or whatever. And not only saw things in the stone, but really began to be hooked by it. Now, there's two versions of the story.
Okay.
One version of the story is that an angel knocked on John Dee's window on the second story at Mortlake and handed him a crystal. And that's the crystal ball that Kelly was using. But in the diaries, we find a really different version of that story, in which the crystal ball was teleported, appeared out of nowhere in the middle of one of the angelic sessions. And that was the crystal that was used to bring through the language and the Enochian tablets and so forth. Either way, it's a pretty good story.
And the Enochian language is, well, we can cover that as well. There's a story connected to that.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of the story behind all of these stories.
Oh, it's a good one to cover then.
If you think about what would be required to prove contact with higher intelligence, you know, just think about that for a moment. what would you really need to prove that?
You'd need a lot of communication. I'd need some sort of definable communication or a physical apparition.
Yeah, communication, but again, it couldn't be just garbage. It would have to be communicating something that you, as the receiver, wouldn't know, couldn't be in your subconscious.
Right.
So what the angels put, or the angels is their term, what these beings put Dee and Kelly through for years was a process of receiving information that was so far beyond what they knew in their conscious and subconscious mind as to be literal proof of some sort of higher intelligence. The connections to how DNA and transfer RNA work, amazing. The higher dimensional geometries, the fourth and fifth dimensional geometries in the structure of the system, truly amazing. And the way the language itself works, totally unique on the planet in the history of human languages, both natural languages and creative languages, there is nothing like it. Well, so on all these levels, mm-hmm. we have this proof of something we could call higher intelligence.
Right.
So when you add that to the fact that, well, yeah, Kelly actually did two of the most documented transmutations of lesser metal into gold. Okay, that's pretty good. He seemed to have some understanding that we don't quite get anymore. And then you add to the fact that these angels went to all this trouble, not for anything that would happen in Dee and Kelly's time, but they specifically told them that when certain things lined up in the sky, that's when this structure could be used and could come online. Well, guess what? That time happens to be right now. So you go, higher intelligence, you know, given all this information 400 years ahead of time, and it won't come online until, maybe there's something there. Maybe there's a meaning. Maybe this actually means something.
But how did they understand the language? How did they decipher it? This is Kelly and Dee we're talking about, right?
Yeah, the angels presented a tablet of the letters of the alphabet and the titles of each letter. And Kelly was supposed to memorize these so that he could read the other tables that they were going to show him.
Right.
And Kelly didn't do his homework. So they came in for the session, and the angel literally squeezed Kelly. Dee recorded that he announced that he felt like he had a fire around his head. And when this experience was over, this sort of, you know, almost kundalini-like experience, Kelly could suddenly read the Enochian letters. He had been connected at some deeper level to the letters and the language. Eventually, the angels would give them a translation of a lot of this stuff years later that is just perfect.
Right.
Perfect in the sense that Enochian, Ophanic, actually is a language that has a syntax and a grammar and a structure. But it also has these totally alien characteristics, like the titles of the letters. In English, the title of A is A. Right? Mm-hmm. The title of A in Enochian is Va. You know, and it's like V-A-N. Okay. Each of those components of that title leads to other components and to other components in this sort of branching tree-like structure that connects every letter with lots of other letters, so that the meaning of just saying a simple phrase in Enochian sets off all these enormous resonances. And guess what? The structure of this 8x8 grid that the angels wanted Kelly to memorize overlays perfectly with the codons of the DNA one way, the proteins of transfer RNA another way, the I Ching, and the center of the Mayan calendar. And there are other connections. But that grid is sort of like, okay.
It's so a little odd that they would get information 400 years ago that we really only understand now. I mean, exactly. What they knew of DNA, I don't know.
They had no clue. They had no clue. They were working with it from the number, sacred geometry sort of point of view, 8 by 8, 64. But they had no idea either about the I Ching, 64 hexagrams, or how that would work, 64 codons of DNA.
There were 64 Enochian, what do they call, titles.
Right. 64 characters in the 21-letter titles. Very complex. And again, as you go deeper into the system, you find things like Penrose tiling sets, which is a very complex mathematical idea that only came along within the last 40 years.
Right.
But here it is 400 years ago as a component in this larger system.
A four-dimensional cube within a cube.
Cube within a cube. And again, beyond that, the whole idea of the 24-cell four-dimensional figure, which is this complex mega geometry. In which all other solids tend to nest, and that's in there too. It's like, okay, D, the smartest man on the planet in the 16th century and one of the best mathematicians, could poetically conceive of the idea of higher mathematical dimensions. We actually have...
But he'd have to do that in his head.
Yeah, he could write about it, but he couldn't describe it mathematically. Right.
Right.
So he could poetically describe it. He could describe it with sacred geometry. But he had the concept. And that may have been why the angels chose him. But beyond that, in the material that they received so carefully, is this fantastic web of these higher dimensional geometries and connections to DNA. Again, so that if you say one word in Enochian, you set off these resonances that literally cause things to happen down in your DNA.
To alter it, to change it, to...
To alter it, to change it, to perhaps bring it up to standard, you know, bring your DNA up to code.
Right, right, right.
And that's the larger part of what the angels seem to have been talking about. They gave these great tables, right? And these great tables were said to be aligned a certain way towards certain stars. And in the 16th century, when the tables were received, that alignment was about 6 degrees off. And now, well, guess what? That alignment is almost spot on with all four tables. So it's like the system with the tables is designed to come online now. The angels said as much. So why? Well, it turns out on these tables are these little squiggles, these little tornadoes. And they seem to act as filters, templates, so that the energy, say, coming from the sun, perhaps even from something like a Carrington event, could be processed through these filters and therefore actually be beneficial to humanity and to our evolution as opposed to very destructive. So it's curious that this higher intelligence, seemingly from the DNA, 400 years ago, would so carefully dictate the system that seems to be effective now and that seems to be designed to preserve and help our DNA evolve through what could be a pretty bizarre cataclysmic moment.
Right. And we can you can track this back. The Enochian language, you can track back through history.
Really. You can trace some roots. Mm-hmm. There are parts of it that seem to be Old Kingdom Egyptian, for instance.
Right.
But it's not really an Ur language. Do you remember like the holodeck in Star Trek?
Yes.
Imagine that our world is just a very sophisticated holodeck.
Okay.
And what is creating this hologramic reality is higher computer codes, like the Matrix.
Okay.
And imagine, for instance, that you could have a glimpse of the computer language that would operate those codes.
Okay, I get it. I thought you were going to tell me I was sleeping in a tube and had a bunch of things attached to my body, but...
No. I don't, you know, who knows? Go that far, but...
Wake up, Neil.
Yeah. But it is a similar idea of, okay, there is a higher coding, and that coding seems to be connected to our DNA, obviously. And that may be what we're calling Ophanic or Enochian.
No. Okay, we're going to have to go for a quick break now.
Sure. Sorry, I got wound up.
You know, that's fine. It's perfectly fine. We're very fluid here. But we're going to go for a quick break, and we'll catch you guys on the other side.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's Lepingo, lapingoproducts.com.
You've always been told to think about the alternative. Well, we can do better. We can show you. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com will improve your health, well-being, and lifestyle through hundreds of different products, from herbs and well-being products to our large selection of specialty clothing, jewelry, and more. We ship around the world with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. There's always new products and amazing specials. Let us show you at AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com.
And we're back. Talking with Vincent Bridges, who's talking about the Enochian language, and John Dee, and Kelly, and all kinds of interesting things in history. Just quickly, before we go any further and get caught up in talking again, do you have a website that people can check out? And I know you have some books, and are they available on your website?
Well, the books, Mystery of the Great Cross at Hindeh, it's available through Amazon. My website is vincentbridges.com.
That's easy.
And goldenmean.info/ofanim, I-M, it is also a good source for some of the Ofanic material.
Okay.
We do have a book coming out this week called The Ofanic Revelation, coming out in English. So if you check vincentbridges.com, we'll have a link there as soon as it's available. And we do have an Italian version of the Ofanic Revelation that came out about a year ago and has been doing quite well.
Yeah, no doubt. We'll put a link to that on your profile in our past shows, on our website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com. So if people want to check there, they can get the link, or they can just go to vincentbridges.com, which is easy to remember.
Yeah.
And we'll run it from there. Well, that's great. You got a new book coming out. That'll be amazing. I'm looking forward to reading that and checking it out. Okay. Everything we've covered now. You know what I want to know? I want to know if people are still studying the language, the Ofanic language.
Well, it's broken up into a couple of odd groups. Mm-hmm. The magical people who go, ooh, it's really strange and weird things happen when you do this. And then there's the group of historians who are interested in D and the time period and the whole idea of Renaissance magic as an academic study. And then there's a very small group of people who have been taking it seriously as a computer language, computer model. And some of those folks, they're a spinoff from some of Dan Winter's people and other sort of connections. But again, we have a small group of people in northern Italy and in Prague. And we're actually working with the idea of creating this shield, if you will, creating this space using the language over the next year or so before 2012, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very fascinating experience. Just last fall, I was in Italy explaining some of this, and the people got very excited. There was a couple of computer builders and programmers there, and they're going, "You're talking about a quantum computer. This is a quantum computer from the 16th century." And I'm going, "Okay,
if you say so."
So yeah, there's an enormous amount of depth to this. That, like I say, if you're looking for proof of higher intelligence, this is pretty high up on the scale.
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead, Tom. You have a question.
Is there still a lot of material that needs to be identified or, you know, maybe hidden in there still?
Most of the material is a lot more available now than it is when I started working with it a long time ago. Then you had to go to the British Museum and get microfilm and all sorts of stuff. Most of Dee's manuscripts are available on the British Museum websites and at other places. You can find lots of copies, which that's a great benefit. There's still weird pieces of things left in odd manuscripts and in odd boxes. We just discovered back about a year ago a box of completely unclassified, uncategorized documents in the Rosenberg archives in southern Czech Republic. And they're all alchemical. They relate to Dee and Kelly. And we may actually have in that collection and then in another collection of Dee manuscripts, some authentic signatures and letters from Shakespeare himself. Now, that's still open because we haven't really done all the research work yet. But, yeah, there's still things out there. There's still missing pieces that we would just dearly love to find. But most of it is available, and it's amazing how much there really is, given...
But do you think it... But do you think all the information on there has been deciphered pretty much?
Deciphered? No. Let's put it this way. We know enough of what came through the sessions. In other words, we have enough raw material to begin to flesh out the ideas. But the ideas are so complex, like I was saying with the quantum computer, that you could flesh them out for years in just an amazing variety of ways. And so, no, it hasn't been completely deciphered, but there's enough there to go, okay, this is some really intriguing stuff. And, again, that's mostly what's in the Ophanic Revelation is how some of this more complex geometry and connections to DNA actually work.
Yeah, that is interesting. Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned how it connects to the Mayan 2012 concept, the center of the galaxy. The center of the galaxy is connected here as well. Is that true?
Yeah, well, it seems that almost everybody, Eastern and Western, and it's even the Mayans, although they were counting it slightly different and looking at different things, seem to agree that there was a very precise moment in time that was going to be problematic. Jesus's return or the birth of the Messiah. And that, of course, was when the winter solstice sunrise lined up with the center of the galaxy, although they didn't know that. They saw it as when the winter solstice sunrise fell under the left foot of Ophiuchus, or the serpent hole. Now, that's the 13th sign of the galaxy, the 13th sign of the zodiac, and it marks the center of the galaxy. The left foot of Ophiuchus is standing on the center of the galaxy. So when the sun is in that position, it's the galactic alignment. And of all the different signs of the zodiac, Ophiuchus is the only one that's had a very similar meaning throughout time and throughout cultures. It's always been the one who brings order out of chaos. Marduk and Tiamat. And again, in the Middle Ages, it was St. Michael and the dragon.
Right.
So, of course, it would have meant that, okay, this is the moment when something very special relating to revelations, etc., would be happening. So everybody's been sort of working around the same framework because it's something obvious in the sky, again, if you have the secret, if you have the key. And so the different calendars, including the Mayans, are focusing on the same event, maybe for the same reasons, maybe for entirely different reasons. But the event is important enough in the long range of time to be marked in this way. So, yes, that's part of what the angels were talking about, is when we have the tablets aligned so that you're in the flow of the galactic alignment, that's when they're supposed to come online. And again, whether that flow is connected to why we're having such weird solar weather and the high probability that we're going to have something similar to a Carrington event over the next few years, or whether it's all, you know, sort of related or just kind of coincidental, quote, quote.
And the Enochian, right, the Enochian information, it points to, and what does it say? Does it say that there's a specific, not event, but effect?
No, it essentially, the angels told Dee and Kelly not to do much of anything with all this stuff. And it was all dictated backwards, for one thing. It was all went to great lengths to make sure that it didn't accidentally do something. And they were told that they couldn't do the whole system then, that they had to wait until a certain alignment of the tablets happened in the sky. And that alignment of the tablets in the sky indicates that it's the time period now. It's this galactic alignment time period.
Right.
So the angels only said, okay, don't do anything. You'll know when these things line up properly. It's the time to actually use it.
Yeah.
And, of course, I'm sure, you know,
Not that you'll be alive, but...
Yeah, Dee, of course, could calculate that was 400 years in the future. But he had a planetary dating system that would have put around this era to be a time when we're shifting from one planetary angel to another. So there are many ways that he would have understood how that would have worked. So, yeah, it's like, okay, they were pointing these higher intelligent beings from our DNA or connected to our DNA. Was pointing to this time period as a time period when our DNA would be in danger. And this language, this connection, this very strange computer system seems to have been specifically designed to allow us to survive, I don't know, this season of catastrophe, as Fulcanelli called it.
Yeah, Fulcanelli did some work on that. And how is Fulcanelli connected? That's an interesting side street.
Oh, yes. Well, see, Fulcanelli is connected through the amazing unseen connection to Prague. And it's truly bizarre. But briefly, Prague has this whole thing about being a new Jerusalem in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Templar church called In Jerusalem in Prague. And the stained glass windows of this Templar church have the exact same set of symbols as the Hindu cross, indicating that someone around 1220 already had the same information that Fulcanelli was pointing to, which, again, is the indication of the time period we're talking about. So there is this weird overlap between the fact that whoever in the Middle Ages was helping to align these churches towards Jerusalem and towards the winter solstice sunrise knew that eventually, 1,000 years or so in the future, it was going to be the apocalyptic moment when St. Michael would be standing on the rising sun, or, you know, again, that huge Ophiuchus above Jerusalem. That's in the direction of Jerusalem. And that was sort of, they're building for this huge spot in the sky. Now, Fulcanelli talks about when the terrestrial cross and the celestial cross align. Well, in Prague, it's built on a terrestrial cross aligned to the celestial cross, the solstices, and it's pointing toward the most terrestrial, earthly of all crosses, the crucifixion spot in Jerusalem. So in Prague, at this time period, you have a spot, like Fulcanelli was pointing to, where the celestial cross and the terrestrial cross align perfectly. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Fulcanelli did say that if you could find that spot, that would be your, quote, place of refuge, unquote.
And so he was talking about Prague.
Well, I don't know, but it seems to me that that's a fairly good assumption with what we know.
Or he could have been talking, okay.
Could have been talking about Prague, and let's just say that Prague has more entertaining hermetic images per square foot on its house fronts and church fronts and et cetera than any other place on earth. I can do a walking tour in Prague and have done this and just simply gone to alchemical spots and walked all the way from Old Town Square to the castle.
Wow.
it's that kind of density of esotericism through time. 1,000 years of Masons, Rosicrucians, Templars, Gothic stoneworkers, theosophists, you know, all kind of in a bowl in this crucible, this highly energetic crucible.
Tesla as well.
Oh, yeah, Tesla.
Yeah.
All sorts of very energetic.
There's some stones there, three stones stuck in the ground, different heights.
Oh, yeah.
What were they, the devil stones?
Yeah, that's what the locals call them, what the churches call them. They call them the devil stones. They are the remains of what was once a large megalithic monument up on this hill called Vysharad, which just means high hill, high castle. And it was the ancient pagan sun-watching time alignment spot. It also has one of these 11th century rotundas. But when they began to build up there, the Christians all kind of, you know, broke them up, threw them away. And these were the ones who kept coming back. And the story is that the devil would fly them back every night, no matter how many times they dumped them in the river. So eventually they just piled them up and left them, and they're still there. Now, if you look at them closely, you can see what I mean by how intense the meteor strike was and how melted and fused this granite is.
Mm.
And in the granite, there are flecks of gold. In other words, you can just simply stand there and look at these stones, and you can see the alchemical process that happened spontaneously in the meteor strike. They're still right there. And they have an amazing energetic field if you douse them or use the electronic instruments. They're huge. Now, the story is that the pagan queen Libusa, who was a visionary, stood on that spot and looked across to the other hill where the castle is now and saw a vision of this beautiful golden city whose fame would reach the stars. And she named it Praha, or which is doorway or threshold, portal. And so that's kind of the legend that's connected with that whole energy there on the hill and the stones and so forth. And it's a very deep and kind of pre-Christian and very magical way to look at the energy in this very amazing spot.
Right. And you're actually traveling soon over to where are you going again?
I'm going to be in Prague for a few months, and then southern France. We're doing the tour again. Yeah, I'm going to go do some research, finish up my Shakespeare, John Dee, Edward Kelly research in Prague, and finish up a couple of book projects I've got in the works. I'm going to be in the Czech Republic for the next few months.
So after this book comes out next week, you'll have more books.
Well, I'm turning all the Shakespeare stuff into a nonfiction and a fiction sort of version. It just depends on which one gets sold first, which one would get finished. And it's interesting to try to tell the story in a fictional way. You can get richer detail. You can give it more meaning than just reciting the bare facts and footnoting and so forth. So it's really fascinating. It's a very rich subject. But yeah, we have classes and workshops scheduled on the Enochian stuff right on through the summer of 2012. We have a few people from America who's coming over, but at this point it's mostly a European group, folks in Prague, folks in northern Italy, some good folks in Malta. Malta is also, interestingly, part of the story with the Knights of Malta and their alchemical connection. Plus the megalithic structures on Malta and its connection to the whole.
And how are the Malta? How is that connected?
Well,
connected to John Dee and Kelly and the whole.
At a time period when there was no other major grandmasters commandery in Europe for the Knights of Malta, there was one in Prague, and the Knights in Malta in Prague have always sort of guarded certain, you know, interesting locations on their side of the river. And there is a connection between the Knights of Malta and the whole Hende, end of the world, Carrington event, alchemical process that circles between Jerusalem, Prague, and when they ended up in Malta. Now, okay. Malta is very interesting because Malta, not just for the Knights, but it has this amazing megalithic stuff that goes back to what we could really only call Atlantis, the previous high culture.
Yep.
There are structures on Malta that are predating any other standing stone structures anywhere in the world by a good 1,000 years. And there are underground structures that are older than that that have these same architectural components that we really have no idea who could have carved them or what they were for. So there are a lot of connections going forward and backwards. And again, all the way back to how we actually evolved back into something close to human beings after the last catastrophe. And then how do we survive the one that may or may not be upon us at the moment?
Now, how did we evolve? I'm not going to let that lay there.
Well, it appears that a group of caveman types stumbled onto something in Malta. And that something is these underground chambers. And there was a jolt to their DNA. And a huge evolutionary leap happened. And it happened first in Malta and then spread throughout the whole Mediterranean basin. And we're talking about a time period in which even Egypt had no stone structures. So it all sort of started in Malta and kind of exploded elsewhere within the next 1,000 years or so.
Wow.
So that appears to be the point where humanity got its DNA jumpstart from the 6,000 years or so of darkness after the last cataclysm.
Tom, do you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, again, going to a similar question, was there a connection between John Dee and Shakespeare and all these guys with the Templars as well?
Oh, boy. See, that's a really curious question. The Templars were officially disbanded long before this time period. But in Prague, that, in particular, very curious little remnants survived. I've traced a couple of literal secret societies, one known as the Brotherhood of the Circle, around Prague for 150 years before Dee and Kelly's time. So there were remnants of this same information held by both the Knights of Malta and these little underground groups like the Brotherhood of the Circle that Dee and Kelly, Kelly in particular, seems to have been in contact with. You have to understand, Rudolph was such a crazy person that he attracted all sorts of other crazy people. And crazy is just sort of a metaphorical term. They even had an official alchemist guild. In other words, there was a guy who would check you out and see whether you were a real natural philosopher or whether you were a con artist. That's how many people they had coming through and presenting these ideas. So there was this huge ferment of ideas, huge sort of overflow of just all sorts of new ideas, all sorts of ways to do science and connections between science and spirituality, a real ferment. So in the midst of this, there had to be kind of ways to sort through it. So you had an alchemist guild.
And that's where they checked you out.
Yeah, and that's where they checked you out. And sort of, if you have a guild like that, then you have some sort of structure. But again, you have a structure that is sort of like, you know, how should we say, based on certain ideas. And where do you get those ideas? Well, those ideas go back to the groups you can't see. You know, the only successful secret societies are the ones that nobody's ever heard of, right? If you're a secret society and someone's heard of you, well, sorry, your usefulness is gone.
Right. You ain't so secret, right?
That's right. You ain't so secret no more.
But a little bit of, but a lot of research goes into digging those up. I mean, you know, you yourself included, right?
Oh yeah. Everything leaves traces, and that's That's why you really have to be sort of skillful at your history, let's say. Yeah. Because if you know where to look, you can find traces of a lot of stuff that is not in the overview, you know, that sort of fell through the cracks of the textbook version.
Right.
And in some places, it's just simply like keep asking a question to you get to the person who actually knows an answer. Right? You know, why is this street named this? And eventually you'll get a story. So, okay. And if you keep doing that long enough, if you keep asking the people, local people long enough, you turn up all sorts of amazing stories, rumors. And again, in a place like Prague, where you have these overlapping esoteric groups for 1,000 years, you have some pretty amazing rumors. You know, and again, it's like, okay, I guess we really can preserve information just simply by telling stories and having these, you know, group identities in which certain things are known, you know, secret societies, quote unquote.
Right. Right. Where later become mythologies, right?
Right. And, you know, again, Rosicrucians, well, the founder of the first Czech Republic was a Freemason and a Rosicrucian, a fellow lodge brother of Woodrow Wilson. And Vaclav Havel considered himself a Templar. He actually bought the Templar Church called In Jerusalem, his foundation did anyway. And it's now this amazing crossroads of cultures and ideas and so forth. So it's like, okay, that's good. The tradition continues.
Right. What about the stories of the Templars' hidden treasures that are still out there somewhere?
Well, there's all sorts of stories of Templar gold. I would imagine that if there's anything left to find, it couldn't be much.
But couldn't gold be a metaphor for knowledge?
Yeah, it could be a metaphor for knowledge. And it may actually be pointing to the fact that the Templars had a chunk of the meteorite, the Kaaba stone from Mecca, that they used as their source of prima materia. And if you follow the trail in Fulcanelli, it suggests that whatever's left of that prima materia is buried under a certain pillar in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris.
Right.
Which, of course, you know, no one's ever going to let you dig to see if it's there. But
not going to happen.
Not going to happen, no.
No.
I go and visit it every time I'm in Paris. Though, I go, oh, there's the pillar.
Yeah, just to get a recharge.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you mentioned the cross of Hende a few times. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? And you've written some work on.
Fulcanelli is one of these really strange people. He's very French and very mysterious. But apparently he did successfully form a transmutation using palladium-infused gases, which is a whole nother story. That's another one of the scientific keys. But he wrote two books, and in one of the books he talks about how there's a variety of symbols hidden on these churches, the Gothic churches. And the symbols are all hermetic. And long after he was supposedly dead, in the second edition of this book, Mysteries of the Cathedral, there's a chapter about a small, strange little cross in the Basque country of southern France at a little place called Hendaye, or Hende, if you're southern like we are. And the cross, sort of put together in, say, the 1680s, and it has a metaphor that suggests how you align, again, the faces of this cube and tell time with it. And if you align the faces of the cube and the other clues properly, it points to a time period roughly from 1992 to 2012. And this Fulcanelli describes as the season of catastrophe, the great cosmic alignment, the time when the terrestrial cross and the celestial cross are in alignment. And this was sort of like a mysterious kind of chapter. And again, it appeared long after Fulcanelli was supposedly dead. And it predicted certain things without saying how it was predicted. And it was full of riddles and, you know, very strange enigmas. So my co-author and I, Jay Widener, spent quite a few years chewing on that one. And eventually, after several hectic scurries around France, I came up with a very plausible theory about when we could read the time and how it was interrelated and how it relates to the larger problem of the theory behind alchemy. And again, one of those threads was, well, it looks like the Templars had something. And that's sort of where this part of the story goes in a different direction. And that's where it starts with the alchemy story specifically that ends up with Kelly and Dee. And
so they're all, what you're saying is all this stuff is interconnected.
Yeah, it's all part of a much larger thread of the same story. Who's got the secret? Who understands the secret of time? How does the secret of time relate to alchemy? And again, how do we keep from going into a really bad dark age? And how do we perhaps use the energy that's being radiated by that angry sun, like it's on the Hyundai Cross and the church?
And why are all the ancient philosophers trying to kill our generation?
Oh, that's a much larger...
They don't like us much. But that connects to the sun and the activity. The sun is sort of weird right now, and has been for a while. The minimum was a hell of a minimum, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, and you know about a Carrington event, right?
I may. You can describe it to the listeners.
Well, there was a Professor Carrington who was an astronomer in the 19th century, and he was into sunspots and recording solar cycles. Right. And he discovered that there was a period in which certain rather unusual things happened, and then at the end of that, the sun would have a huge solar flare, coronal mass ejection, etc. The one that happened in the mid-19th century was so intense that the aurora borealis was seen all the way to the equator for a good half a year. Now, if we'd had any electronic devices in 1841, I think it was, they would all have been fried.
Right.
And just gone. Well, guess what? The pattern that the sun has been going through since 2000 is a lead up to a Carrington event. And in fact, we've had several really entertaining flares, et cetera, in the last 6 months or so.
Well, they've also had strings on the sun.
Just huge things that tend to indicate that there's a coronal mass ejection coming. So the best science on that would indicate that we will have something similar to a Carrington event, maybe not truly horrible, but at least pretty weird, sometime between now and winter 2012, when the solar maximum hits. So we can expect there to be some really bizarre activity. If we are directly...
It's already
in the
bizarre.
Way, yeah. What do I call pretty bizarre?
I mean, no, I said it's already bizarre. I mean, have you...
Oh, well, yeah, that's just...
There's
that's
pictures
just
of orbs around the sun. I don't know if you know about this, but it's been all over the internet. These orbs that are showing up around the sun, and everybody's going, what are those? And weird events, and it's just...
They could be our angelic beings. They could be who knows what at this point.
Yeah,
yeah, they're the
Checking
size
out
of
the
Earth.
Place.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is exactly what if you tell the story about angels and people's quaint thoughts of visiting with angels and stuff.
Well, everybody seems to think, oh, angels, aren't they cute and so forth. And to a certain degree, that's a good way to kind of visualize them. But there's a poet, Rilke, Rainer Marie Rilke, who is a native of Prague, who wrote a series of elegies and described angels in their true nature. That if you could really experience an angel in its true beauty, it would be terrifying. It would be overwhelming. The experience would just annihilate you. And these beings that we're talking about, they're both inside your DNA. That's where the intelligence seems to be. But they also seem to be the size of nebula. They're huge, energetic, self-organizing structures. And it could be that that's
plasma
the direction...
Beings.
I'm sorry?
Beings? was a plasma being. Plasma
being. Yeah, Dan likes to call them plasma beings, but he tends to reduce everything to certain qualities.
Yeah, we had Dan on the show a while ago.
Ah, yeah. Dan and I are old friends. We go way back. We've covered a lot of this angelic stuff together in one way or the other. If you think of them as plasma beings, then you also have to consider that inside every cell of your being, there are more of these plasma beings. And that's all DNA may really be. It's just a little frozen moment in this huge, swirling, dissipative structure that we casually name evolution. But it may be this huge cosmic tornado, this huge self-generating, self-regenerating structure. And we're just little swirling bits in it. You know, we're just debris caught up in the tornado.
That would be the fractal nature of it, or the microcosm in the macrocosm.
Right, right.
Of the universe.
And again, the hologramic nature of what we're caught up in seems to be part of this language that the Enochian beings, for want of a better word, have given us. In other words, it's the ability to speak directly to our DNA and to these large cosmic dissipative structures, tornadoes, at the same time. And that may be where consciousness has to go in order to survive, you know, the Carrington event that's bearing down on us. If you think about energy coming into a grid that can alchemically, for want of a better word, transform it, then the energy that's about to hit us can be just the jump start we need to go to that next level of evolution. Doesn't have to be destructive. Doesn't have to be the end of the world.
No.
It just depends on us.
Yeah. Yeah. The ancients want to kill us, but we want to stay.
We just have to get smarter. That's all.
We have to get smarter on a planetary level, which is, that's asking a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, human beings, I rather jokingly call Homo sapiens sapien as monkey too smart for his own good. And then we're a variety of that called killer monkey because we killed all the other smart monkeys.
Mm.
And it's like, okay, somehow we have to evolve beyond that basic programming. We have to evolve beyond our instincts as killer monkeys and actually become human beings, true conscious participants in, you know, the greater reality. And as long as we're just killer monkeys, man, it's a good thing we're confined to the earth.
I think this is our prison.
Don't
let the humans go to space. We don't want them out there. There's rules out here, and they won't follow them.
Well, one way to really upset the UFO people is just simply to say that everything you described to me, abductions, crazy sightings, you know, all this, it's just the sociologists and prison guards dealing with us here on this prison planet. That we're just places, you know, of confinement. And guess what? We're going to be stuck here until we learn compassion.
I think Tom would agree with you there.
There'll be a while for that. Be a while for that one.
Well, it probably will. But who knows? Anything is possible. It just turned Wednesday here, so I'm in an optimistic day. So
yeah, I'm glad we got you in an optimistic day. I think Alan got you on a not so optimistic day. But that's okay. We all go through. I mean, some days I see the human race as glorious potential, and then other days not so much.
Yeah. Well, it sort of has to be that way. We have this curious thing called free will, which means that we're really free to blow ourselves up, you know, screw up in any number of ways. But that's what makes it exciting, because maybe we'll get it right, you know.
Maybe we will, and maybe
maybe in 50 years we won't be around.
Yeah, it won't matter too much
because
to us.
We run out of water or something else.
Yeah, but you know, there will be a certain culture and a certain society. Of that, I'm fairly sure that there will be something beyond whatever happens in the next 50 years. And I would just like to leave that something, as much information, as much hope as we can. You know.
That's what you, that's what you're working towards. You're working towards just get the information out there. You know, there's a lot of people doing that, though. Also, the Jay Wilner you mentioned, he's working really hard at doing this sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, well, we're all sort of, like I said, it's a very small world in certain of these circles. And, you know, a lot of us sort of decided a long time ago that the best thing we could do was be observers and try to save the juicy little bits. And, you know, it's sort of like building an ark. You know, let's find this little piece and make sure it doesn't get lost. So hopefully, yeah, whatever culture there is will appreciate what we've been doing.
So your job is to figure it out and write it down.
Yeah, that's been my job for a long time now.
Yep. It's a good job. I'm gonna just throw this at you just for the hell of it. Do you think there are – what are your thoughts on the so-called Illuminati, that there is a group of people who got all the toys and they don't want to share them?
Well, gee.
That's a big question. It could be a very small question.
The Illuminati, historically, we know quite a bit about, and therefore it is a very unsuccessful secret society.
Yeah.
The idea of illuminated ones, which is what Illuminati actually means, is a much broader subject and actually encompasses a lot of what we've been talking about.
Oh, okay.
In the illuminated brotherhoods, which go all the way back to Egypt, there are certain symbols that indicate your awareness of the secret. And I'm going to tell you one of those. It's something called LVX, or light. And it's how you use the letters LVX, which are all angles. And if you understand how to use that, then you're an illuminated brother. And this is a very ancient recognition set of symbols going all the way back to Egypt. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the illuminated brothers are those people who are working for human evolution, working towards centropy, order, light, etc., as opposed to chaos.
Right. So we're not really talking about the bankers.
No, see, they may call themselves an Illuminati, but to them it's just a joke. You know, J.P. Morgan said 120 or so years ago, there's no such thing as a conspiracy. It's just like-minded people agreeing on certain principles. And right. Those principles are, if you got money, you want more money. If you have power, you want more power. And we don't really care about the people who don't have money and power. And it's a political problem. It's a governmental problem. It's not a secret conspiracy, et cetera. Conspiracies, particularly conspiracies of people who are greedy, never work because somebody will always spill the beans.
Right.
Now, there are secret groups that we know nothing about who have done some pretty amazing things. Some of them inside the church, some on the outskirts of the church, some just totally out in left field. Mm. And we have traces of some of those, the Rosicrucians. You know, that's a trace we have of a group that we really don't know, but seems to have had a very profound influence. And in those, you can see the, quote, secret societies. But to think that the Bilderbergers or the Skull and Bones, that they really own anything more than just the material realm, it's to kind of miss the point.
Right,
evil has a human face, and it's totally banal, and it's made up of greed and ego. And, you know, it's like we give evil way too much credence.
Right. They're just playing in that ballpark because it works for them.
Yeah.
It works for them.
Exactly. And if you want to play by those rules, okay, you're going to have to get down and swim with the sharks. But frankly, you know, I like the dry land, you know, where the trees are and the fruit, you know.
I'm big on the dry land as well, yeah.
Yeah. Let's go a different direction. Let's not get down and...
I don't really need to dominate other people to elevate myself.
Yeah, exactly. You know, all I need is a little peace and quiet to get my work done.
I mean, we're happy with that. Okay, so we're going to close down. What I want you to do is I would love for you to give your website out, the title of your books, and and information on your upcoming book, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. My website is vincentbridges.com. The upcoming book is called The Ophanic Revelation. The book on Fulcanelli is The Mysteries of the Great Cross at Hendaye, and it's from Inner Traditions Destiny Books, available on Amazon. Let's see, I think that's the major ones.
Okay, that's great. And yeah, he's going to have a new book coming out. We'll have a link to it on our site. Go to www.vincentbridges.com and you can check it out there. It's .com, right?
Yep, .com. Okay. Vincentbridges.com. Very simple.
Okay, well, that's great. Now, you know what? You opened it up now, and we closed the show there, and I have more questions. I'm going to have to talk to you again. Maybe when you're over in Prague, you're going to have Skype over there as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't survive without my international voiceover protocol connections.
Okay. Well, maybe what we'll do is we'll contact you in the midst of your research over there to tweak out some tidbits of what you're doing. How's that sound? Okay.
I'm actually going to be living in a house owned by Edward Kelly.
No.
Yeah, really?
Really?
Yeah.
And he did part of his work. Wow, that'll be awesome.
Oh yeah, there's alchemical stuff down in the basement, in the crypts, as they call it. And there's very strange paintings and writings upstairs in the observatory, in the tower.
God, you're never going to leave the house.
Well, I seem to have my work cut out for me. Yeah. And the universe has said, okay, you want this? Here it is. So.
Wow, good for you. He's going to be staying in a house that has a crypt.
An alchemical crypt.
Yes. An alchemical crypt at that. Okay, well, we're going to close her down now. And thanks, Tom, and thanks, Vincent.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we'll catch you guys next week.